Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Diana Nyad.
Thank you, Taylor. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, every day we pick up local newspapers, every city around America, and we read that our youth, our teens, are just hanging out. They're just getting into trouble. All they do is spend time in their screens. Well, I beg to differ. When I've met you guys from the FFA, you are engaged in your lives. You're the future of America, and I'm so darn impressed. Nice to be with you. You know, whenever you hear a life story, if someone were here today who was a brain surgeon or Yo-Yo Ma, the great cello player, you listen to the eccentricities of a life story. It has a very particular vocabulary, but you extract from it the metaphors that mean something to your lives. So my story reads like the story of an endurance athlete. This Cuba swim is the Mount Everest of the Earth's oceans. If we were to spread out the nautical charts of the Earth's surface on this stage today, we couldn't find on this blue jewel of a planet, 4/5 of our planet ocean, a more difficult swim, a swim where Mother Nature rages on steroids with currents and with sharks and with the particular deadly box jellyfish, with eddies, with the difficulties against a swimmer as rage between Havana, Cuba, and Key West, Florida. So this is my story, and it started young, emblemized by my song. Now, you guys in the band, don't laugh at me on this one. Revelry. Revelry's my song. What does it mean? Get up. Don't miss the morning. Don't miss anything. And I was lucky. This ethic was introduced to me when I was a little kid. I had a Greek father. He was dramatic. Every day was an emotional exaltation for Aristotle Zenith Naiad. He would wake us kids up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and with his thick accent, his buzzing Z's and his rolling R's, he would cry out to us, "Kids, I have just been to the ocean. It is a Rembrandt painting. We need to go see it. It will change your lives." And we said, "Dad, we have to get up in a couple of hours. We have school. I am your father, and I am teaching you life lessons right now. And let me tell you, the first lesson is sleep is highly overrated. Get up." 20 minutes later, our whole family is strolling along the ocean's edge. The golden moonlight from our ankles all the way out to forever. It was a Rembrandt painting. It changed our lives. Well, on my 5th birthday, my dad called me into the den. And over here on the desk, he had opened Webster's big, fat, unabridged dictionary. He had his hands resting on the pages. Tears were standing in his eyes. But I was used to that. And he called to me, "Darling, you are coming here. I have been waiting for this day for you to turn 5. Because now you are going to understand the most important thing I will ever tell you. Darling, come here. Your name, my name, the name of my people, it is in the bold black and white, the important book, the dictionary. Tomorrow, you will go to your little preschool. You will ask your little friends, is their name in the dictionary? They will tell you no. You are the only one. Come here, darling, I'm going to read for you. Naiad, in Greek mythology, my people, the nymphs that swam in the lake, river, ocean, and fountain to protect for the gods. And definition number 2, darling, this is the one for you. Naiad, girl or woman champion swimmer. Oh, my God, darling, this is your destiny. Well, I didn't know what destiny was. I was only 5. But the word I heard that day was champion. And I started walking around with my shoulders just a little bit higher. It's not long after that, elementary school, I had a geography teacher who was an ex-Olympic swimmer. The most charismatic character you'd ever want to meet, after my father, of course. And he said that any kid who came out for the swim team would get an A in geography. I've learned since that many athletes start their careers this way. And I was at the pool the next day. He had us all swimming up and down. And after about 15 minutes, I stopped in this lane over here, and he was standing over the lane. And he yelled down, "Hey, you, kid, you, what's your name again?" I said, "Naiad." He said, "Naiad, you're going to be the best swimmer in the world." That's all any kid needs. I thirsted for the commitment of it all. 4:30 in the morning, every day, never an alarm clock needed. 1,000 sit-ups every night, elbow to knee every one, never 999. I was a little dedicated swimmer. And right at that time, the Cuban Revolution broke out. Literally, thousands of Cubans flooded into my hometown, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We were eating Cuban food. We were flying the Cuban flag. We were dancing the salsa in their living rooms. We had the mystique of Cuba. You know, all of Earth's great adventures have to do with the geography. The English Channel was first swum in 1875, not just because it was a particular stretch of 26 miles of cold water. It's because it had the history. It carried with it the continent of Europe and the isles of the United Kingdom. Well, here, today, in our world, there is no more famous body of water than between Cuba and the United States since the Revolution of 1959. They call it the Cuban Graveyard. We don't know how many hundreds, thousands of Cubans lie at the bottom of that ocean from trying to get across to freedom. I had a mystique about Cuba. Even as a 9-year-old, I stood on the beach with my French mother, who spoke with a thicker accent than my father, which is entertaining right there, to grow up in a home where you have to ask both parents to repeat themselves all the time. I said, "Mom, Cuba's out there somewhere, but I can't see it. Where is it?" She said, "Oh, I'm going to show you. Lift your arm up this way. No, no, it's more this way a little bit. There. It's right there. As a matter of fact, it's so close that you little swimmer, you could almost swim there." Well, all of that beginning, hearing about the destiny of your name, champion swimmer, your mother pointing out across the horizon, saying you could almost swim there, those weren't the concrete formations of dreams. But I'll tell you something. In retrospect, all these years later, those elements fluttered in the back of the imagination. So in my 20s, which were the 1970s, I did become the best ocean swimmer in the world. I had the records for swimming around Manhattan Island, from the Bahamas to Florida, etc. But always, always, it was about Cuba. As I said before, the Mount Everest. All the other swims to me were adventures, challenges, but they were part of the world of sport. Cuba was life. It was living large. It was having an impossible star. People had been trying, men, women, fast, since 1950, and nobody had ever made it across. Maybe that star was untouchable, but it made you touch down to the nth degree of potential, become everything you can be, summon every drop of courage in you, and all of your team the same. You don't go out there alone. It's an expedition. You've got a shark team. These are the dangerous sharks of the tropics, the oceanic white tips, the tigers, the lemons. How will I ever thank those guys, my shark team? They dive below me in pitch black. We use no lights. Lights attract jellyfish. Lights attract sharks. And they're down below me all night long looking for the fluorescent eyes of the predators, which are always there. But are they going to come up and charge toward me to take a leg? How am I going to thank my guys for putting my life ahead of theirs? All night long, several nights in a row. The box jellyfish is the most potent venom on earth. 90% of all people who have been touched by a tentacle of the box die instantaneously. Your spinal cord is paralyzed. Anaphylactic shock takes your breath down to 2 or 3 a minute. You feel like you've been dipped in hot, boiling wax. I'm yelling to my head trainer, Bonnie, on the boat when I was stung in a swarm of millions of them, fall 2011. Bonnie, I'm on fire. Help me. Help me. 1, 2, 3, 4. And I lived, partly because we have a medical team on board. You've got a boat here. With that expedition, you're not allowed to touch the boat. You're not allowed to get out. But you tread water next to it, and you deal with crises. And now the crisis was the box jellyfish. I should have died that night. Yes, they reached over. They were giving me EpiPen hits. They were giving me oxygen and adrenaline. I hope it doesn't sound too braggartly. I think I survived that night and kept swimming and swam all the next day, debilitated, weak, stung the next night again at dusk, swam that entire night, the next entire day on will. That's what it's all about. So I walked down to the shore in 1978. I was 28 years old, what you might call the prime of your athletic career. I was brash, cocky. I said, jellyfish, sharks, get out of my way. 42 hours later, I was humbled. Not only is the distance undeniable, nobody had ever swum even half that far in the open ocean before. So picture the map facing you. If Havana is down here to the south, you're trying to go over 100 miles in the open sea up to Key West here, and add to that distance, down here comes squeezing, catapulting out of the Yucatan Channel, the mighty Gulf Stream, the most powerful current on earth. And right above Cuba, that current is flowing hard to the east, 6 times any swimmer's speed, Michael Phelps, much less mine. And every time you're over next to your boat, stopping for just the normal, every 90 minutes, a little bit of electrolyte drink, a little bit of food, try to get a new pair of goggles on, or you're in crisis, you're in hypothermia, you're hallucinating freely. Now you're stopped for more like 7 minutes or 11 minutes, and you're being dragged east into the Atlantic Ocean. And that tangent of 100 miles, seemingly impossible to start with, out here now becomes 130, 150 miles, and way over here, 7,000 miles away, off the west coast of Africa, is where the summer storms that become hurricanes develop. They're blowing winds. Those storms are blowing their easterly winds uninterrupted across the Atlantic Ocean and through the Florida Straits, and those winds come up against that Gulf Stream current, and almost every day out there you've got stiff peaks. 1 day a month on average does that wind die down or clock down around to a different direction. A swimmer needs 3 days to make it across. Las Vegas put this swimming chance at 0.002% of making it. So I tried it in 78, and I didn't make it. Every expedition's a learning curve, whether you're coming back from running across the Kalahari Desert in 125-degree heat or climbing Mount Everest. You come back with knowledge, science, innovation, a new way to drill down into that will. And we had new stuff going into 1979, but we couldn't get visas. We trained the entire year, and yeah, this swim took 53 nonstop hours, but it's the training. You swim 14 hours one day. You're lying in the fetal position on the bathroom floor that night. You can't get up and get into bed. You're so whipped, but the resolve is there. You know no stone can be left unturned. The next day, you get up, and you do 15 hours. And at the end of a year, you feel like you could walk through a brick wall. The resolve has gotten you there. You know, I have a tremendous regard for the Earth's extreme endurance adventurers, maybe specifically the alpine climbers, the people who go up to Annapurna, the summit, K2, Mount Everest. Ed Viestiers is a friend of mine. Ed says when he's above 26,000 feet, he's climbed Mount Everest more than any other human being, the pure way, without bottled oxygen. And Ed says when he takes a step like this of just a few inches, the duress on his pulmonary system is so egregious that he has to stand there and compose himself and take a minimum of 25 profound breaths before he can take a step of just another couple of inches. Well, I don't know what it's like at the top of the world, but I am the only one who knows what it's like far offshore on your own steam in a vast, dangerous wilderness of an ocean. And the issue that's different for me than for a climber, a runner, a cyclist, is sensory deprivation. You don't have your eyes and your ears. Your ears are covered with a tight, sealed cap. You're trying to keep the heat in your head. You're immersed in a liquid 15 degrees colder than your body temperature. In the beginning, you feel great. It's the tropics. After 30, 40, 50 hours, that liquid is trying to pull your body temperature down closer to it than your normal temperature. You're trying to digest like this in the supine position, and almost all of that nutrition is going into empty spaces instead of your digestive system for the contraction of your muscles. You've got fogged over goggles, and you're turning your head once a second. You never focus on anything. In a very quick time, you are in the interior of your mind. You're up with Stephen Hawking and the majesty of the universe. Your childhood is wafting in and out of your brain. So I developed a series of logarithmic counting and a series of songs. You're not listening to headphones. You're just hearing them. It's part of the discipline. You'll take a song like, it's not of your generation, but you may know Janis Joplin's version of Me and Bobby McGee. And I take that song, and I can hear Janis's voice in my imagination. I can hear the guitar strums. I can hear the band. And I would take that song, and with precise metronomic, that stroke grooved in after years, precision, sing it 1,000 times, never losing count. And I'm trying to stay up close to remembering who I am and what I'm doing. I'm in it. I'm engaged instead of way out with Stephen Hawking. And I'm out there, especially at night, grooved in 1,000 times. Busted flat in Baton Rouge, waiting for a train, feeling about as faded as my jeans. Ooh. All the way to the end, just the way Janet recorded it. La 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 la, la 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 la, hey hey hey, Bobby McGee, yeah. 767, busted flat in Baton Rouge. And when I get to 1,000 Bobby McGee's, I am at precisely, not a second over or under, 9 hours and 45 minutes. So it's an intense experience out there. 1979, 1980, training hard, getting the expedition together. Can't get into Cuba. Visas flat out denied. Most people on my team saying, we're ready to swim 100 miles. You know, have you seen Guam this time of year? It's lovely, really. Cuba was in my soul. I didn't want to go to Guam. And I gave up my beautiful Cuba dream. Maybe it's the tragedy of world-class sports. You retire when you're young. It's the only profession where you have to do so. Are you ever going to feel that passion again? Are you ever going to rise up to that level of commitment again? Are you ever going to dip down into a talent well that deep again? And I'm not going to complain. For the next 30 years, I was working for the wide world of sports, ABC, Olympic Games, Wimbledon's, Fox Sports, National Public Radio, traipsing around after the best in the world and watching them, reporting on them, pursuing their excellence. But I kept my eye on Cuba. And every time a swimmer would try to make it across, I like to think myself a sporting person. I wasn't wishing them harm or anything. But when they wouldn't make it, I would be doing a little happy dance at home. Oh, the dream, illogical as it seemed, was still alive for me. You know, toward the end of that 30-year period, you can imagine I had met so many remarkable people. But the bravest soul I ever met was Christopher Reeve. I don't know if you know Chris's story, but in a heartbeat, he fell from his horse and became a quadriplegic. And regrets were very big with Chris. If you met him, within seconds he would say to you, "Do not leave it for tomorrow. Whatever you're dreaming, do it today. Do it fast and soon. Don't put it off. You don't know what proverbial banana peel you may slip on." And he asked me where my sort of philosophy as a world-class athlete came from. And I said, yeah, I was walking down the pool deck, Olympic trials. I believed I was going to be an Olympian. I didn't know my talent yet was going to be swimming over the curvature of the earth with a steel trap mind. Last swim of 8 years of 4:30 in the morning, 1,000 sit-ups every night, one more 100-meter backstroke. Am I going on to the elite Olympic trials, or am I going on to the rest of my life? I felt the weight of the world on my shoulders walking down that pool deck, and a teenager, when I was a teenager, came and gave me words of wisdom I've lived by ever since. Suzanne shook me and said, "Well, you look like you're in a fog. This is the most important race of your 8-year career. Why aren't you in a tight focus?" And I started in with all the sacrifices my brother and sister had given up so that I could pursue my own, my parents. She said, "It doesn't work like that. You know it doesn't. You don't have the big perspective in mind when you're chasing the moment." She said, "Remember, we just saw that incredible documentary, television special on the great tennis champion, Billie Jean King. And at that time, Billie Jean said when she goes to Wimbledon, she doesn't march over and look at the 2-week draw and say, oh yeah, in a couple of weeks, if I get her in the quarterfinals, I've heard her second serve's improved a lot." No, Billie Jean says she's like a cheetah on the hunt when she steps onto the grass at Wimbledon. She doesn't know who the umpire is, what the weather forecast is. She doesn't know what her opponent's weaknesses and strengths are. She's not even playing the ball. The first Zen athlete, Billie Jean, is playing the fuzz on the ball. And as the ball comes over, cheetah on the hunt, she tracks it down. She sweeps into the most perfect backhand that's ever been hit. If the ball comes back, there's Billie Jean at the net with her signature overhead, and boom, 2 weeks later, she's walking around with the Wimbledon trophy above her head, which she did, by the way, 20 times. So my friend says, you get it. You think about all the sacrifice and what it all means later. For the moment, it's the fuzz. No, listen to me. Maybe it's not as poetic as the fuzz on the tennis ball, but I want you to look. I want you to look at this little half-moon pinky fingernail, the backside right here with me. Because you know why? That race of yours tonight, you're going to make it or not make it by that much. I need this girl right now. I'm under her spell. We're standing on the pool deck as if the couple thousand people virtually disappeared like this. I said, yeah, I see it. She said, all right, I'm asking you, in the 100-meter backstroke, how long does it take you to swim that little half-moon pinky fingernail distance? I said, well, I don't know, that's going to take a thousandth of a second. She said, no, it's not. Do the math. It's going to take a lot less than that. I said, okay, you're right. is going to take a thousandth of a thousandth of a second. She said, that's it. So why don't you go over there and blast off those blocks with the shoulders you've built for 8 years, with the heart that's unique to you. And when you touch that wall, don't look up at the electronic scoreboard. Close your eyes, close your fists, and say, I couldn't have done it a fingernail faster. I guarantee you, no matter what happens, you do it that way, it'll be all right. And I blasted off. I had a vision. Don't leave a fingernail in that pool. With my shoulders and my heart, and when I touched the wall, I didn't look up. I closed my eyes. I closed my fists. I said it, and I meant it. I couldn't have done it a fingernail faster. I took a deep breath and looked up, and I didn't make it. I walked into the locker room. I thought for sure a cascade of tears would come from believing for 8 years, but they didn't. I stood there tall and proud, because it wasn't just that 100-meter race. It was the entire 8 years, every day. And I walked out of that locker room a young person, your age, and I said to myself, no matter what you do, succeed or fail, every day of your life you're going to do so you can't do it a fingernail better. No regrets. So I told Chris Reeve this story, and he loved that story, and he said, well, you know what the clear question is? You said you walked out of the locker room all those years ago, and you made a promise to yourself. Is this the way you've been living all this time? Not a fingernail better every single day? And I said, I'm not the kind that sits around on the sofa and eats Cheetos all day, but I really haven't done a reckoning. I haven't looked into that nth degree of living for myself for a long time. Chris, I want to get back to you with that promise. And I never did speak to Chris again. He died. And then my mom died. Dors bien, maman. And then I turned 60. You're not going to believe me out there, but you're going to blink, and you're going to be 30 and 40 and 50 and 60. I was racked with an existential angst. It wasn't about what I had done. It wasn't the ledger of, had I broken some record, was I in a couple of halls of fame, had I made some money? No, it was, who am I? Am I the person I can admire? I went digging around for a poem. It had meant something to me at once, and I knew I needed it now. That summer of turning 60, which was August 2009, I took it with me everywhere. I must have read it 1,000 times. I had it walking the dogs in the morning. I had it with the breakfast cereal. I had it by my bedside. I had it driving in the car. Mary Oliver's The Summer's Day. The last two lines, a brilliant rhetorical question. Tell me, what is it you're doing with this one wild and precious life of yours? It hit me like a ton of bricks. I'm going back to chase that dream, that distant, maybe untouchable star, that vision, Cuba to Florida, that's going to make me be everything I am and everybody around me. We put the expedition together, and we tried and we failed. We tried and we failed again, and we tried a fourth time and we failed again. And now in front of the whole world, CNN, everybody was on the story. They found it inspiring. Now they called it impossible. And they wrote me letters, the great sports scientists, Sanjay Gupta from CNN, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and said, this swim will never be done. Vegas went down to 0.00% chance. And I wrote them all back and said, we've appreciated the respect you've given our team. We've learned a lot from a lot of you. But what you're forgetting is the most critical element of this endeavor, of any endeavor, and it's why you can never use the word impossible, and that is that the success of this journey is all about the power of the human spirit. And there we were a fifth time. And I will tell you, I had some fear. I was looking out at a horizon that looked farther away than it ever had before. But I took the leap of faith and the real leap. And 53 hours later, there was suffering, there was joy, there was the nobility of friendship with my 44 teammates. And the night I was shivering, the second night, I forgot who I was and what I was doing. Bonnie, my head handler, blew the whistle for Shark. You stop. You silently dog paddle over to the boat as close as you're legally allowed. She said, what do you see? I said, I see the stars. No, lower. I said, I see black, 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 black sea, black sky, nothing. She said, so rip off the jellyfish mask. Rip off the goggles. You've got to see it. You need it. I looked and I said, oh my, it's the sun. The sun's coming up. There was a little white filament across the black. The sun's rays are going to warm my body. You know how it is. You see the sun and you feel hope. And she said, it's better than the sun. Those are the lights of Key West. And for 35 years since I first tried it, I had faith that someday our expedition was going to be the first to make it across. I stumbled up onto that beach and there were several thousand people waiting and they were crying. No, they were weeping. And you know why? It wasn't because they saw an athletic record broken. It's because they witnessed somebody and a team who refused to give up. I believe it. Whatever your dreams are, whatever your particular other shore is, yeah, you need some talent. You need hard work. You need some connections and colleagues and friends. More than anything, you need that human spirit that says, I'll get knocked down, I'll get back up. And one day, if I just don't quit, I will reach, you will reach your other shore. I admire you for what you do, kids. And I thank you so much for having me be your speaker today. Thank you. Thank you. Can I get a selfie with them? Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Woo! Can I get a selfie? Woo! Good luck, everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.